Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. And today we are going to be talking about water. I'm very pleased to be joined on the line by Kate Greenberg. Kate is the Western Water Program Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are located out in Durango, Colorado. Thanks for getting up early to join us on the line today. For folks who aren't super familiar with the kind of Durango and the Colorado agriculture landscape, can you give us some kind of high points?
Sure. Well, you know, we're here in the arid west with lots of vast spaces between us, lots of ranch land, high country grazing. We grow all kinds of crops from orchards in northern Colorado to grass pasture, mixed vegetables, and all kinds of specialty crops here in the southwest portion of the state.
So a real diversity of things. Now, the National Young Farmer Coalition, their work really is to represent, mobilize, and engage the national movement of young farmers here in the U.S. and really provide opportunities and push that movement forward, really bringing a higher degree of success to young farmers. And as the Western Water Program Director, what is kind of like your purview? Who are you serving? And can you tell us a little bit more about the role?
Sure. Well, the National Young Farmers Coalition, we were founded in 2010 by three young farmers out on the East Coast in New York. And we were founded around the idea that essentially the challenge that land is no longer affordable to the next generation of farmers and ranchers.
Yeah.
These three young farmers were unable to access affordable farmland. And that was true in New York. It was also true in other states around the country. And so we formed the coalition back then and since then have been advocating for policy reform to enable more young people to enter careers in agriculture and then build successful businesses as well. So out here in the West, land access and water access are inherently interconnected. So we, you know, to be able to address the land access issue in the arid western states, first we need to be talking about water.
So water comes from, I feel like we're going to get like a little elementary here, so kind of bear with me, guys. But again, just to kind of like try and paint a picture of the landscape that you're dealing with, where does water for agriculture come from?
So water for agriculture, and actually for everyone who uses it in the West, starts in the mountains. I mean, it's a water cycle, so it could really start anywhere in the cycle. But the way we think about it is our snowpack is our storage, is our best storage out here in the West. And then once melt begins, the snowpack melts and travels through rivers and streams and then is diverted onto farms and ranches. And right now we're starting to enter peak melt, which means rivers are flowing, ditches and acequias are flowing, and folks are starting to irrigate.
So one of the things that's interesting about farming and like the timing of water is like those things don't necessarily always align. Like it might be kind of like peak access to water during this time of year, but folks obviously need water throughout the year. So how do you kind of manage the timing of access to water? I mean, is it as simple as we think about here in Brooklyn, where I just go and like turn the faucet on and the water is there? I mean, how is access to water different for an agriculture producer than it might be for someone in a more urban space?
It's extremely different. And actually, it's not only different between urban and ag, it's different on every single operation. So, you know, the farmers who are on surface water, they are often They may be pulling directly from a stream or river. They may be dependent on reservoir storage releases. The storage capacity of the reservoir that they depend on may vary from others nearby and thus, you know, essentially run out of irrigation before neighbors.
Can I just interrupt you real quick? When you said, like, farmers who are relying on surface water, what is surface water?
So surface water is water that flows, that you can see, essentially, okay. That flows over the land,
right.
Versus groundwater, which is drawn from aquifers.
Got it. Okay, sorry. I feel like water and water access is one of those things that we talk about in, like, these very abstract ways. And so, like, I really want to get a sense of, like, what we're looking at and thinking about. So I'm like, I'm going to be asking a lot of, like, very basic questions to just kind of help orient us. So depending on what type of operation you are, your access to water, your primary water source is going to be different. Is that right?
It's really based on location and where your water right comes from. If it's a storage right, which means if your actual water has been sitting in storage, you know, in a reservoir above your farm or ranch, or if you're pulling directly from a river or stream, it really varies based on the operations of the system too. When releases happen, how full the reservoir is. This year in Colorado, so far it's been a very wet year, so a lot of, you know, we have good snowpack and it looks like a good irrigation season. That does not mean we're out of the drought. And I think the other side, sort of the more of the macro side of the water access question is it moves beyond the actual water that's available for a farm. And, you know, what we talk about out here in the West with National Young Farmers Coalition is actually the access young people have to getting on irrigated land in the first place. You know, irrigation management is one thing, but if you can't access that irrigated land because it's unaffordable or because of development pressure, then, you know, the irrigation practices are somewhat moot.
Because no one's on that land or because it's not accessible for, like, an entry-level farmer?
Both. And really, you know, I think we're entering sort of a fork in the road where we're at a decision point. So in the U.S. as a whole, farmers over 65 outnumber farmers under 35 by 6-1.
Wow.
So we've got a huge age gap. At the same time, we're anticipating that around 2/3 of the working lands in this country, or about 573 million acres, will change hands, will need a new manager in the next 20 years. So we've got this huge age gap in the farming population and an immense amount of acreage about to transition. But, you know, this new generation of producers, of young farmers who want to get into the business, who want this to be their life and their lifestyle and their livelihood, are unable to access all that land. It's unaffordable, and the water that comes with it is unaffordable as well here in the arid West. So that's the context of what we're working in. You know, if we can't get more young people into agriculture and building successful businesses and reducing the barriers to their success, then we're going to face a huge crisis in land succession.
So, I mean, are we not seeing that, you know, these families that have, you know, the primary operator is in that kind of 60-plus category, is it just that their children are not deciding to continue farming, so then you have this land resource with the infrastructure on the property that is just kind of outside the price range, that there's not, like, there's pressure also within farming families for people to move off the farm?
Yes, I'd say that's the case for sure. You know, a lot of farmers, older farmers and ranchers, don't necessarily have a younger generation to pass their land and their business onto within the family. And so we're seeing a lot of land succession templates essentially that are outside of the family. So a landowner who's, you know, seeking a land link partner, for example. So there are programs in various states that link up young and beginning farmers who are seeking land with, you know, farmers who have land and are seeking a successor. So that's an effort underway and something I think that we need to scale up immensely. You know, I think traditionally it's hard to look outside the family to pass the farm on, but, you know, so many farmers and ranchers have poured their life into building their operations and stewarding their land. They want to see it stay in agriculture.
Right.
And so looking for, you know, I guess unique models of land succession is critical at this point in time to keep this land in production.
And you said, you know, you spoke a little bit to development pressure. Now, that's something I really understand here on the East Coast with, you know, looking at kind of urban sprawl and people wanting to have their, you know, McMansion in a beautiful kind of agriculture landscape outside the city. But what is the development pressure? Is it the same kind of sprawl and desire for like open space that, you know, homeowners are looking for? Or is that development pressure coming from some other arena?
Yeah, it's fascinating out here. It's actually twofold. It's land and water. So we've got, you know, similar development pressure as the East Coast in terms of new developments on agricultural land, especially along Colorado's Front Range as an example. You know, of course, in Colorado, we're a headwater state for the Colorado River Basin, which means that you know, the water that originates here, we need to send down to lower basin states, so to California, to Arizona, to Nevada, and also to Mexico. And then on the east side of the Continental Divide, we have the Rio Grande headwaters. So, you know, the waters flow down through New Mexico and Texas. We've also got a number of other rivers that flow out of the state. So when thinking about, you know, water access, it's always within the context of interstate and international water sharing and water compacts. You know, in addition to new development on agricultural land, there's also pressure to be removing water from agriculture for urban development. So historically, and actually to this day, this still happens, there is a process known as buy and dry, which is essentially when a piece of property with water rights is purchased by a municipality or other entity that's focused on urban development or urban growth. Mm-hmm. And then the water is actually removed from the land and moved into the urban area. This has devastating effects on agricultural communities. It dries up the land. It's actually got, you know, some big environmental impacts. When land is no longer irrigated, there's a lot of issues with dust, with weeds.
So,
and then, of course, the economy. There's the agricultural economy tanks in that scenario.
So what that would kind of look like essentially is, like, let's say, and I'm just going to, like, use, this is not a real example, but I'm the city of Denver, and I'm like, oh, we need more kind of water to serve our population. So I might, as the municipality, like, purchase a piece of land that has a lot of water, and essentially I would take that water off that land and bring it into use for other purposes away from, you know, where it's located.
Exactly.
Huh.
Exactly. Yep. So there's sort of a remote development pressure in the western states that has to do with water. So it's not just a discrete property that has a new house on it, but it's also, you know, maybe 200 miles away there was a farm that once was a farm and no longer is because the water has now been brought to urban development.
So,
and that's true, you know, on a larger scale as well. In Colorado, we have Trans Mountain diversions, which divert water from western Colorado, which has very low population relative to the eastern slope, and we divert it across the Continental Divide. So there's, you know, that puts pressure on agriculture on both sides of the Continental Divide.
So you know, we talked about a little earlier in the show access to surface water, and then we also talked about access to groundwater. So maybe can we talk a little bit about how, you know, where that split is? Like if you're tucking primarily into groundwater or surface water, are those bringing up different issues, or does that flow kind of happen from the same like primary sources? So if the groundwater is stressed, surface water is stressed, or how are those things like kind of relate? Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it's an extremely complicated question.
Awesome.
I would need, I think, some PhDs on the line to really get to the core of that answer.
Broad strokes, like, I mean, I'm just curious.
Strokes,
yeah.
Well, groundwater and surface water are connected. I mean, they're all part of the water cycle. With groundwater, there are different, I guess, layers of groundwater. You might have, fossil water, which has essentially been untapped for millennia. Mm-hmm. You might have very shallow aquifers. There may be places where surface water in stream is visibly connected with groundwater. You can actually see the groundwater, the water table, rise and fall based on the stream flow. But it's totally dependent on the specific location. And that, I think, is a critical point for understanding water in the West, is that, we have some basic concepts that connect us, that connect all of our water systems. But really, to be able to make any change, it has to be as local as possible, because every region and every ditch, every well, they all are essentially part of an ecosystem that's very particular to that location and to the people managing it in that particular spot. So we're, in the West, it's relatively recent to be managing groundwater and surface water conjunctively, as up two pieces of the same system. So I think we have a lot of ways to go to understand the connection, but we are moving into a moment in time where it's becoming much more apparent and much more a part of our management and policy making to be looking at groundwater conjunctively with surface water management.
Well, it's also this thing that we have to kind of collectively as a population decide, like, hey, what your neighbor does kind of impacts you, and what you do impacts your neighbor. And there's like this kind of, we all have to agree to be working towards a similar space with regards to usage and conservation, but also kind of keeping the water supply, clean and safe and those types of issues. And I'm wondering, what is the state of, like, what is incentivizes farmers to, practice, farmers who have kind of hit the barrier where they've gained access to land, they've gained access to water rights. How are they dealing with looking at water conservation in the midst of, like, just literally trying to run their farm business? Is there incentive for that? Like, how are they being, like, bolstered in those efforts?
I think we have a long ways to go for really, truly incentivizing conservation. There are, a number of programs that help support farmers. The EQIP program through the NRCS can help improve irrigation efficiency on farm. There are, various programs that support soil health management practices, but we still have a long way to go, and that's true of our federal programs, and it's true at the local level as well. The farmers, we surveyed over 400 farmers and ranchers in the West for a recent report called Conservation Generation. Mm-hmm. That was all about young farmers and water in the arid western states. We found that 97% of our survey respondents care about conservation, and 94% are implementing some kind of conservation practice on their farm. At the same time, though, to be able to scale up these efforts, there are still some significant barriers standing in the way of scaling conservation. So we need to increase the incentives. There is a financial burden to conservation and efficiency improvements that many farmers are willing to make because they care about it, but up to a certain point. And beyond that point, if we're going to be scaling up, we need to be looking at scaling up our incentives for conservation as well. And then it goes back to the land access piece. We've got this generation of farmers who are building off of what the farmers that came before them and looking to steward the land and water and grow food for local communities. But to be able to access that land in the first place is still the chief barrier to access land and water. So in thinking about increasing conservation, I think we need to take a step back and say, well, who are the people who will be actually implementing these conservation practices in the decades ahead, and how do we, open the door for them? So that land and water access piece is critical.
Well, and how do you get educated on what that even looks like? I mean, is this something that folks are teaching in, land grant ag programs? Is this type of education happening like producer to producer? How do you, if you're like a young farmer and you're kind of looking to engage, evaluate like, hey, is Colorado going to be the right, you know, place for me? How do you get to know the landscape of the kind of like land water connection?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's there's so much that happens farmer to farmer in at networking events, at mixers, at conferences, by word of mouth. There are obviously organizations too that are, you know, in this space trying to create a pathway into a career in agriculture, and that's, you know, that's where the National Young Farmers Coalition, we really feel that we need to do that through policy reform, through advocating for funding, for affecting those structural changes at the federal and state levels that will, you know, move the needle on getting farmers onto the land and into the positions of business ownership. So, you know, I think all those levels, the grassroots is fundamental, and that's what the Young Farmers Coalition is based on. We are a grassroots organization. Our members are farmers. We have over 30 chapters around the country that are all farmer-led. And they, you know, those chapters of ours, they address their local needs on the day-to-day, but then we also have a Farmer Advisory Council, the National Leadership Committee, that helps, you know, drive our policy at the federal level. So, you know, I think making sure that we stay connected to farmers and ranchers, that we connect them to each other so they can share this information, and then organizations, you know, we do the groundwork on the policy side, the things that farmers shouldn't be spending their day-to-day time doing to try and alleviate the barriers that they face.
Yeah, I mean, essentially you guys are acting as a space to amplify the voices and the concerns and identify, like, what are some of these barriers. Okay, we are going to take just a quick station break to hear a word from our wonderful sponsor. So I'm going to ask you guys to hang tight. We are on the line with Kate Greenberg. She is the Western Water Program Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. We will be right back.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
All right, we are back. We are talking water with Kate Greenberg. She is the Western Water Program Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. I'm wondering, Kate, if you can give us a little sense, you know, one of the things that is kind of at the forefront of folks' mind here at 2016, is, you know, tech, is innovation, is that we're, going to come up with solutions for problems like this, before they become real threats. And I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of a lay of the land with regards to innovation and tech fixes, tech hacks, measurement tools as they relate to water.
Sure, yeah, I think that's certainly a growing field, and it's something of interest to young farmers in particular. You know, right now we're still not measuring a lot of our water use in the West. There are efforts to measure on-farm and off-farm water use, especially as it relates to soil health. And I think, you know, this is a place where we're trying to really influence the water policy discussion, is that, you know, technology is going to be key. Efficiency improvements are critical to meeting, you know, the water scarcity impacts ahead. But at the same time, there needs to be a connection to the soil, right, and to the natural processes of a farm. And I think those two together are actually, you know, where the heart of innovation actually lies. So there's a huge movement going on in soil health right now and recognizing the role that soil health plays in so many things, you know, whether that be increasing the biodiversity of a farm, increasing yield and productivity of a farm while reducing inputs, carbon sequestration, water conservation, the list goes on. And pairing, you know, a focus on soil health with an interest in experimenting with new technology, you know, farm hacking, ways of monitoring the moisture on your farm, what comes off on the farm, what leaves the farm, and how you can improve your management practices with soil, with water, you know, based on what kind of feedback that technology gives you. I think there's a huge opportunity to explore solutions to water scarcity through that nexus of soil health and water management.
But it's not, you know, as simple as just kind of like Googling and like buying a couple of quick tools and we're like, hey, we're there. It's understood. We're kind of in the like emerging space there. Or, I mean, as far as kind of impacts that you're actually like seeing, where do you get a sense that we kind of are?
Yeah, I think we're in a great place of experimentation.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, there's so many pressures coming down. There's water scarcity because of so many reasons. You know, there's drought, there's the impacts of climate change in the West, there's increasing development pressure, an increasing population. There's all these things putting pressure on ag producers, on farmers to experiment. And, you know, I think something that's often missed when we talk about farmers, you know, off the farm, is what innovators they are already on the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, farmers and ranchers are out in the field every single day observing what's going on, thinking about how to do things better, but they only get one chance a year to experiment, you know, just based on the seasons. So I think there's, I want to be sure that, you know, we talk about that, you know, farmers have always been sort of pushing the edge of, well, how can I do this better? How can I approach my operation to make it more productive, to make my land healthier, to treat my water better? I think, you know, young farmers are, they have decades ahead of them to be building their careers as farmers, to be tweaking their management and their stewardship. And I think it's critical that we support that innovation and creativity, that we incentivize it rather than, you know, push farmers away from it.
Yeah, I think also understanding the timetable that you're working with. So the reputation that farmers have sometimes as being kind of like tied to old-fashioned ways or adverse to change, you would say that's like not earned.
I'd say if you are creative, if you're innovative, if you like to experiment, if you like to work hard, if you love a good challenge and are excited by the unexpected, you should get into farming. I mean, I think it's an exciting time. There's tons of challenges. I think, you know, especially with water scarcity in the West, I think young farmers and ranchers have a huge opportunity to actually be at the forefront of finding solutions, and solutions that work for agriculture, that keep land in production, that, you know, boost local and regional food production, that increase water conservation, and that bring in new technology and innovation into this space of water scarcity.
I want to shift gears somewhat dramatically, and I'm not sure you're going to be able to speak to this topic, but I want to ask, because you are based in Colorado, you know, with the recent kind of legalization of marijuana, has that impacted your work from an agriculture or water standpoint? Does that like support things that you guys are doing already? Is there any intersection happening there or not really?
You know, it's really not something we work on. You know, focusing mainly on federal reform, we can't, you know, it's not a place we would really go. It's obviously happening here, and, you know, there are farmers growing and using water, and it's, of course, part of the agricultural scene. But it's not part of our focus.
Yeah. I mean, essentially kind of like not going to get your bang for the buck if you're looking at really driving a national movement. Not quite there yet, I guess.
Right, not quite there yet.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Well, so Kate, we have a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering, you know, for folks like myself who are located here in Brooklyn and listeners out there across the U.S. and around the world, you know, if we're not going to pursue a career directly in agriculture, what's the best way for us to continue to like learn about and engage in these issues, support your work, you know, in a small way, in a large way? Like, where would you direct us?
Well, there are so many ways to get involved. You know, wherever you are, you can always become a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition. We, you know, offer membership for $20 a year or $5 a month, sustaining. You can go to youngfarmers.org to become a member. You can get involved in policy. We're always looking for people, you know, whether or not you're farming, we need everybody in support of young farmers to be speaking up. So you can always work with us to, you know, meet with legislators to help on policy reform and advocacy issues. You know, joining a local chapter, helping young farmers in your area organize, going to the places where young farmers are selling their products, often farmers markets or local restaurants, so supporting them with your dollars. You know, in the West, thinking about water conservation, if you're not a farmer, you're still very much connected to farmers because, you know, we are all connected by the water we share, regardless of where we live and where we eat. The water that grows our food, and the water that comes out of our taps, and then the food that travels around the country as well. You know, it's what connects us together as eaters, as growers, as members of a community. So I think having that consciousness, that awareness, and meeting your local farmers, seeing how you can get involved locally, those are all pieces of the equation and ways to participate.
Yeah, and I know folks can visit the website, youngfarmers.org. You can download the report that Kate was referencing here on the site and get a lot more information about the work that the coalition is doing across the U.S. in your area specifically, and of course, become a member there. Kate, any other kind of resources that you look to outside for kind of inspiration, for nourishment? I mean, you're dealing with an issue that is, I think on one hand, you know, if I'm in your shoes, I'm feeling a little like overwhelmed and there's so much to know and things feel very like urgent. And at the other hand, you know, I'm sure on the day-to-day you get to meet inspiring people and, you know, see smaller kind of like bites of success. But when you're needing to kind of like bolster yourself, like what are your kind of self-care practices or your go-to reading or like eating, or how do you kind of stay optimistic and upbeat to do the work that you do?
I actually get on a farm and go work. I think just working and not thinking too much is really helpful in all of this. You know, it's when you're thinking about drought and climate change and, you know, 40 million people relying on the Colorado River system, it can get, you know, pretty heady. And getting out in the field and getting your hands dirty and helping irrigate and, you know, harvest food, I think is the most grounding thing you could do.
And for folks out there who want to get a job like yours, what should they do?
You know, just, I guess, follow your passion. I think there's, or create something, just start something of your own. I think there's so much opportunity and really agriculture has a huge future ahead. And it's just up to us right now how we want to help craft it. So I just encourage everybody to get involved.
Yeah, the best. I feel like I always say that to people. Like, the best way to get involved is just get involved, guys. Just do something. Like, don't overthink it. Just show up. Start there. Well, Kate, thank you so much. I've definitely learned a ton. I definitely recommend folks checking out that report and following some of the things that you outlined as ways to kind of continue to stay engaged. I really appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Thanks so much.
Once again, that website is youngfarmers.org. Definitely check them out. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of The Farm Report. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm Erin_Fairbanks. I would recommend following the Heritage Radium Network feeds. It's Heritage_radio. You can get a really great insight into all the different shows we do. And if you're interested in learning more about some of the young farmers that Kate was talking about, definitely check out our weekly show, The Greenhorns. Every week, they profile a different new young farmer. And so lots of inspiration and stories to be found there. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.